Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A southern West Virginia town works to revitalize itself.
It's really exhilarating and affirming to watch it all come to life.
Appalachia remembers John F. Kennedy's assassination.
I was in the White House when the assassination took place in Texas.
A bicyclist pedals across the country, raising awareness of Lyme disease.
I was misdiagnosed, undiagnosed.
And a Kentucky writer discusses his latest book.
I'm not giving anything away to say that on the very first page of the book, Elizabeth's mother turns up dead.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentucky's coal production and employment both dropped during the third quarter of this year. As Kentucky Public Radio's Erica Peterson reports, the state's eastern coal fields recorded the biggest loss.
From the second to third quarter of this year, Kentucky saw coal production drop 5% and shed 439 jobs. But the losses weren't consistent across both ends of the state. Both production and jobs stayed nearly the same in western Kentucky, while eastern Kentucky recorded declines. This report is the latest in a series that shows a negative trend in the state's eastern coal fields. Coal mines have been shutting down or furloughing workers in record numbers. Most recently, James River Coal announced it would close all of its mines in eastern Kentucky, laying off 525 miners. The weak demand for that region's coal will likely continue. As Appalachian coal reserves get harder to reach, they're more expensive to mine, and new environmental regulations and inexpensive natural gas prices have prompted many utilities to switch away from burning coal. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
An initiative that begins next month on improving the economy of eastern Kentucky will not be successful without the support of the people who live in the region, according to the two individuals who are spearheading the effort called SOAR, or Shaping Our Appalachian Region. Congressman Hal Rogers and Governor Steve Beshear talked about it during a joint interview on Pike TV. Rogers says SOAR opens with a summit on December 9th at the Eastern Kentucky Exposition Center in Pikeville.
The governor and I want everyone to come, regardless of station in life or occupation or geography or educational level or anything else. We want leaders there. We want followers there. We want people of all walks of life to tell us what they think ought to be done in eastern Kentucky.
Rogers says SOAR is a response to economic hardship in the region because of job losses in the coal industry. Beshear says the key to success is local participation and ideas.
We felt like if we could bring a bipartisan effort together and bring the leaders and folks, civic leaders, educational leaders, everybody in the Appalachian area together, to look at their own future and to buy into their own future and a vision for that future, then that's the way that we're going to make a fundamental change in this area.
About 600 people have already registered to participate in the summit. Meanwhile, some folks in a southern West Virginia town are rolling up their sleeves to create a better reality for people there. The goal is to turn the main street in Princeton into a safe place to socialize, shop, and grow. As West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly found out, residents basically decided to stop complaining about the rundown reality and do something to change it.
We've got a task at hand. How can we make it better?
Option 22 is a band based in Princeton that composes music with messages of hope, love, and healing. Lori McKinney is the lead singer. McKinney grew up in Princeton, and after an inspirational trip to London, she dreamed of turning her hometown into a revitalized art hub.
It's really exhilarating and affirming to watch it all come to life and see the tide turn. It was like moving mountains there for a while, but now that the dam has burst, you can see the momentum, and it's really exciting. I feel good.
McKinney is also part owner of the Riff Raff Arts Collective, a gallery on Mercer Street in Princeton. The Riff Raff crew has worked to create several creative, artsy events, including the All Together Arts Week, an annual event that happens in the spring. Now McKinney and the Riff Raff are playing a role in the new Princeton Renaissance Project. The vision is to create an attractive, economically vibrant downtown. On the forefront are the efforts to restore the historic L'Avant Theater.
The mainstream public, you know, is really buying into this because they're so excited to see their theater come back to life. And it's not that artsy sort of niche. I think a lot of our programs have been on the artsy side of things. And people around here, sometimes they're just not comfortable because they think, oh, I'm not going to fit into that really creative situation. And there's a variety of reasons that people don't actually participate in events that they view as being hyper creative.
Most of the work is being done on Mercer Street. Like so many main streets in the state, it's a strip of pavement surrounded by mostly run-down buildings with empty storefronts. For now, the Princeton Community Improvement Commission created a grant program to help renovate storefronts. Businesses can apply for up to $2,000 for storefront renovation. New city manager Elke Doom says the passion in town is helping move things along.
When government gets involved and it becomes their priority, it's amazing how many other people will take a second look and say, what can I do? How can I help? And what can we do together?
A few years ago, the city proposed to move City Hall from the corner of Courthouse Road to the former First Community Bank building on Mercer Street. Doom says the city is still committed to doing that. Many of the buildings are stained with strips of tar, crooked mortar, and dirty bricks. But one of the projects will cover some of them with murals.
I mean, that's pretty cool because I've been wanting to paint this town for years and years and years.
Patch Whiskey is one of the paid artists helping spruce up Mercer Street.
I was wanting to paint that building 5 years ago, you know, when I was trying to open up an art gallery downtown here. And they wouldn't let me do it for free. And now they've had to pay somebody, you know, a lot of money to paint whatever they're painting on there right now. But it's definitely changed. You can tell it's definitely, you know, there's a change in the air.
Whiskey's work can be found across the East Coast in cities like Charleston, South Carolina, Miami, Florida, and now his hometown, Princeton.
I mean, every mural that I do, I'm dropping rainbow monsters on people, and I don't really have sketches for anything that I'm doing, so I pretty much just kind of attack the wall, you know, and kind of go at it, and the story kind of unfolds as I keep painting. In this particular mural, there's a rainbow monster stumbled across a bubble-to-bubble salesman. He sells mystery boxes.
To convince more people to visit downtown, the project is working to change its reputation for drug trafficking and prostitution.
I just see some people here that put on their shoes and they go to work. But their work's a little different from, you know, a 9-to-5 office shift, you know. They're kind of freelancers, I guess, you know, in a way. They find different ways from the guy that pushes the shopping buggy down the street collecting cans, you know. I mean, there's different ways to make money out here, I guess.
A nonprofit organization, Community Connections, is looking into ways to help make the downtown feel more secure, including the installation of cameras. The group also purchased the theater and helped pay the mural artists. The city also found the finances to help cover the costs of the murals, and Lori McKinney says that's a good sign.
That's brilliant to me to know that the city was willing to get on board with supporting, actually paying creative people, because that's the sign of, you know, a community that understands progress, is understanding that creative people need to be paid for their work, just like any professional.
But the efforts aren't really about money. Part of the movement includes activities or social events that basically require volunteers to roll up their sleeves. Like on Artist Alley. The project blocked off more than 20 spaces on two walls, separated by a narrow strip of rough, rubbled pavement. Any artist was able to cover a section of the wall with a masterpiece. Lori McKinney was there for the alley party.
This was like the most awesome social experience for the artists. A lot of people met that hadn't met before. And we hung out here for like 2 weeks straight, and at night the beauty salon next door would let us use their electric, so we were able to hook up lights and music. It's kind of like an art club. Everybody was just hanging out. And let me show you the backside. Rita Montrose from Concord and some of the artists that you just met.
McKinney says the final plans are to repave, install wrought iron archways and lights, creating a 24-hour art gallery.
This is all volunteer, and it's interesting because the one that we're standing right in front of, Austin Persinger, he's a professional artist, you know, and he typically works with oils, and this is his first acrylic experience, but It shocked me. When I put out the word, I thought it was going to be mostly student artists because it was a volunteer
project.
Most
of these events don't require a whole lot of upfront cost. Most of these events really pay for themselves.
Sam Franz is one of about a dozen folks at this week's Circle Time, a regularly scheduled get-together where citizens, artists, business owners, and even the city manager meet to brainstorm about ways to make the Princeton Renaissance a success. The group has organized outdoor movie viewings, festivals, and in October, trick-or-treat on Mercer Street.
The whole idea being to give people a really good reason to come back down to Mercer Street. Lots of fun, and I'm surprised at how eager all the local businesses are to get out and help us with this.
During this meeting, those attending Circle took a little time to reflect and admit things are different than a year ago.
Instead of saying, oh, that looks terrible, and complaining, we just all got together and said we've changed.
We've got the arts, and we have education, government, nonprofit, and just the regular folks all pulling together to bring this back to, I can't say the old glory, but a whole new Mercer Street.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Princeton.
From the ground up, build it up. A new institution. We got to make a blueprint. A blueprint.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Friday was a day of reflection and remembrance for many. It was 50 years since President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. The killing shocked the nation and the world, and to this day people still talk about it. We have two reports, the first from West Virginia Public Radio's Ben Aduccio, followed by Kentucky Public Radio's Emil Moffitt, taking a look back at one of JFK's appearances in that state.
November 22, 1963. The city is Dallas, Texas. The President of the United States, John Kennedy, is traveling through downtown in an open-top convertible accompanied by his wife and Secret Service agents. As he passes through Dealey Plaza around 12:30, shots are fired. Later that afternoon, this news report from Walter Cronkite would change the course of American history.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
A nation was devastated.
I'm Mara Brackett, and I worked in the John Kennedy administration in the West Wing of the White House.
Brackett lived in West Virginia for nearly 20 years.
I was in the White House when the assassination took place in Texas and got a call from one of our good friends who happened to work with AT&T. And he said to me, Mara, he said, what's this? The president has been shot. And I said, oh, my, cold shiver went through my body. And I said, I'll call you back. And I called Henry Hall Wilson, with whom I worked, who was down in the mess. And being a good lawyer, he said to me, Mara, where'd you get that? And then I could hear the mess just exploding. Everybody, up and up, everybody all of a sudden had discovered about the assassination. At that time, of course, we didn't know how bad it was. After the assassination, that afternoon, the new President Johnson arrived by helicopter, and we all were out there and greeted him. And much as our hearts were broken, you still had to move on.
My name is Robert Holroyd. I'm an attorney in Princeton, West Virginia. And in 1960, I was the local campaign manager for John F. Kennedy when he was running for nomination as president of the United States. I was in my office at that time. It was in another building up the street here. It came over the radio, and people started rushing in the office. And we were sitting there glued to the radio. Nobody had TVs in their offices back then. It was 1963. People were gathering around just trying to get every piece of information you could have. And for some time frame there, it was uncertain as to whether or not he was alive. And there was some question as to whether or not Jackie was injured and some other people. So everybody was just hanging on their seats to listen to that information. I remember exactly where I was and exactly what I was doing. Almost remember what I was wearing that day, because it was such an event that people who knew Kennedy and who were connected with him couldn't believe that this had actually happened.
I'm John Douglas. I live in Berkeley Springs, and at the time that this happened, I was probably in a classroom in Reisterstown, Maryland. It was a Friday afternoon, and I was in a Spanish class, and we were just going about, the Spanish lesson when the principal came on the intercom system and told us that the president had been shot. A few minutes later, he came back on the intercom and told us that the president was dead. And so I think the class just sort of ended. We just sort of sat there and stared at each other.
Gaylene Miller, I'm the state director for AARP in West Virginia. I was 5 years old, and I remember how devastated my parents were. And I couldn't quite put together what was happening or why it was happening, but I knew it was a very sad time. And the other thing I remember is seeing LBJ sworn in on Air Force One. And my father said, "This is a life lesson. Anybody can be replaced."
My name is Larry Gross. I'm the host of Mountain Stage. And on that day, I was in high school, Adamson High School, in Oak Cliff section of Texas, which was about two or three blocks away from the house that Lee Harvey Oswald was living in. I did not skip school. Some of my friends skipped school to go downtown, and they went over to watch the motorcade and to watch Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy come through Dallas. But I remember seeing a friend of mine, and he came walking back into the building. I saw him as he was coming in. I said, "Hey, how was it?" And what he said was, "They shot Kennedy." And I thought, and I said, "Yeah, come on, man, And he said, "And they shot Conley, too." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "They were shot." And I said, that cannot be. I said, "This is not funny, He said, "No, I'm not joking." And all of a sudden, the principal came on the loudspeaker and said, "Everybody go to your homeroom classes." I went to the homeroom class, and it was a history professor who was also a Baptist preacher. And we sat down, and the principal came on and said, "There's a report from downtown that President Kennedy has been shot and Governor Conley has been shot." And we all, we sat there stunned like everybody else in America. And then after it went off, I never forget this. Our history teacher was also the debate coach. And he had all these books, public affairs books of speeches. And he went over and he opened up and started reading a speech of John F. Kennedy to us.
The president's road to the White House in 1960 ran right through West Virginia, It was viewed by many political strategists as a major victory. A Northerner, an Irish Catholic, winning in West Virginia, a state with mostly Protestants. President Kennedy's story has resonated with thousands of Americans, including Kelly Masterson. He's the writer of the television film Killing Kennedy. It's an adaptation of the book written by Bill O'Reilly.
I know that West Virginia was particularly important to him, and it's where he made one of his most famous speeches, because he wanted to address the fact that he was Catholic, and no Catholic had ever been elected, although one had run prior to that. And he wanted to put the people at ease that he was going to observe a separation between church and state.
An unbelievable crisis has come upon our nation. The chief executive of our Commonwealth has been taken from us. We must mourn. Mourn for the departure of a great man, for the senseless and needless loss visited upon a wife and children. Mourn for a world that can produce so sick a human who would seek to do so dastardly an act. And weep and pray for ourselves and our nation. Weep for our loss, and pray that we can find the strength as a nation to carry on the tasks that have been thrust upon us by the world. May this tragedy not end our nation's greatness. May it only indicate our strength, that even though the leader has fallen, we can still carry on in the spirit and with the might that he would have wanted us to have. El Mole Rachamim, O God of mercies, have mercy upon the soul of your humble servant, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Amen.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
18-year-old Gerald Givens was a member of the Butler County Band in 1960 when then-Massachusetts Senator John Kennedy made a campaign stop in downtown Bowling Green.
We were in front of the of his car, so when I got through with the parade, I grabbed my camera and ran back up the street so that I could get a good picture of him.
Givens captured a picture of the future president riding in a red car with a Kennedy Johnson sign strapped to the side.
Well, at that time I was about 18 years old, and thing politics and all that just didn't register a whole lot. But I knew it was a big event because the streets were packed up one side and down the other.
His memories are just some of those collected in recent months by Jonathan Jeffrey, the coordinator of manuscripts and folklife archives at Western Kentucky. The JFK Memory Project is designed to capture recollections of President Kennedy from those in the area. Part of Jeffrey's research looked into that Kennedy campaign trip to Bowling Green in 1960, an appearance that Jeffrey said lasted just 2.5 hours and included a speech in front of City Hall and lunch at the Kentucky Colonel Motel. Jeffrey recounted a story he collected from one appearance organizer, Commonwealth's attorney Morris Lowe.
When they were bringing the motorcade from the Kentucky Colonel Motel back to the airport, they came by the municipal golf course, which today is a Covington Woods golf course. And he said there were, as he put it, an unusual number of women playing golf that day. And so he said many of them just threw down their irons and raced over to the car, and one woman actually jumped into the car with the president.
Many told Jeffrey they were struck by Kennedy's Massachusetts accent, a foreign sound to a Kentucky audience at the dawn of the 1960s.
In the planning for his visit, there was a lot of discussion of whether they should send President or candidate Kennedy at the time, or whether they should send vice presidential candidate Lyndon Johnson, because he would probably resonate better with local people, you know, having a southern accent, speaking slower, and things like that.
But Kennedy decided that he would come to Kentucky. He wound up losing the state by 7 points to Richard Nixon, but of course won the White House that year. On April 22, 1963, exactly 7 months before his trip to Dallas, Kennedy welcomed the Central Kentucky Youth Symphony Orchestra to the South Lawn at the White House.
And we're glad to have the members of this symphony from Central Kentucky. It's a very happy occasion for me to tell you that we're glad to have you.
In November of that year, President Kennedy would make a trip to Texas, and that 18-year-old marching band member from Butler County, Kentucky, was now 21 and serving in the Navy, stationed in Milton, Florida.
We were having an inspection that day by an admiral that was going to fly in. He got off the plane and walked to the podium and never got up on the podium. Our captain of our squadron got to the podium and said what had happened, which the President of the United States had just been assassinated. So the admiral never did speak to us. He got back in his plane and left.
Gerald Givens says confusion followed.
We didn't know, nobody knew whether it was what kind of an assassination it was. So we were ready to fly away or go wherever they told us to go.
A few days later, they were told to stand down. But just like the rest of the country, he watched the events unfold on television like no event had before. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Emil Moffitt.
President Kennedy's assistant press secretary was a Kentuckian, Malcolm Kilduff, who was traveling with the president that day. In this excerpt from a 1979 interview with retired WEKU reporter Ron Smith, Kilduff talks about what happened that day after Kennedy was shot and rushed to the hospital.
I then went into the what's known as the trauma room and was advised that the president was dead. I then went and discussed it with Lyndon Johnson. And that was always a very interesting aspect of it. I went up to, by that time they had gotten Lyndon Johnson into another room, another treatment room. But nobody had told him anything. And I walked into him to, after all, he was the president, de facto, if not yet sworn in. And I walked up to him, and I can remember very clearly thinking, what do I call him? I can't very well call him Lyndon. And Mr. Vice President was kind of awkward. And in point of fact, he was the president, so I called him Mr. President.
Did he know right then?
That's when he knew he was the president. Lady Bird kind of startled and kind of half screamed. And he came totally to grips with the situation. I said, I'm going to have to announce President Kennedy's death. And he said to me, he said, well, now, Mac, he said, I think we better wait a few minutes. He said, now keep in mind that I had said earlier that we were concerned about the far political right causing trouble. Lyndon Johnson's reaction was precisely the opposite. He said, now, let's just wait a minute, Mac. He said, we don't know whether this is a communist conspiracy or not. That was his first thought, which always interested me because our minds had all been going in the opposite direction. He said, I think I'd better get out of here, meaning the hospital, and back to Air Force One, and then you go ahead and make the announcement after I've left the hospital. And with that, we walked out, Lyndon Johnson, Lady Bird, and I walked out of the hospital through the whole group of newsmen out to his car. Now, I know Bob Pierpoint of CBS, who was standing there, says he remembers seeing me walk out of the emergency room and has no recollection of having seen Johnson. And there is some footage still left around that does show me and Johnson walking out of the emergency room, but they all saw me, but they didn't see Johnson. So by that time, it was a little bit after 1 o'clock, and I fudged around enough time and then talked to the doctors in order to determine how I could, you know, what did the president die of, and at approximately what time did he die, and, you know, the details necessary for a press briefing. Also to find out what the condition of Governor Connally was. And so at 1:31, I got up on what was a little platform in the nurse's instruction room in Parkland Hospital and made the announcement that John Kennedy was dead.
This is a piece of film and audio that we're going to have right now. How rare is this? Because I have never seen it anywhere before.
This film was shot by WFAA Dallas, which has changed hands in their archives, because I was down in Dallas a few years back, and that station does not have their own film, have this piece of film. To my knowledge, you and one other Kentucky television station is the only one that have the film. I do not know of anyone else who has it.
So this is a real rarity then?
Yes, it is, because I have it's been taken on to tape once into a second generation print, but not used any place other than by you, I believe.
All right, this is Malcolm Kilduff then with that announcement November 22nd, 1963.
Go on, Matt.
Okay. John F. Kennedy died at approximately 1 o'clock Central Standard Time today here in Dallas. He died of gunshot wound in the brain.
Slow it down.
I have no other details regarding the assassination of the president.
Anything about the shooter, the sniper?
No, we have no information on that.
Was Mrs. Kennedy here?
Mrs. Kennedy was not hit.
Was Connally
hit? Governor Connally was hit.
Was Vice President Johnson hit?
The Vice President was not hit.
Well,
was
Connally hit? Has the Vice President taken a role?
No.
Can we see him?
He has left.
Where did he go?
I'm sorry for... For reasons of security, I cannot discuss the whereabouts or travel plans of the Vice President.
What's Connally's condition?
I understand that Governor Connally's condition is satisfactory. He was shot twice, once apparently in the side and once in the wrist.
Which one? Which wrist?
I'm sorry, Bob, I don't know.
You say it.
The President was shot once.
Where is Mrs.
In the head. Mrs. Kennedy will be returning to Washington.
Mac, what's the President's
name? I'm sorry.
Was he still
arrival
here?
No, he was.
Mac, in that event and in the event of any unexpected presidential death, what preparations are made? Are any made beforehand, any consultation with the First Lady as to what will happen in the event of the death?
Not really with the First Lady. The surprising part about that is that within the Military District of Washington at Fort Myer, Virginia, it used to be the 3rd Infantry, and I believe it still is, has down pat the order for a presidential funeral.
Kilduff continued to work as an assistant press secretary with the Johnson administration until he became a newspaper editor in Beattyville, Kentucky. He died in a nursing home there in 2003 and is buried at Arlington National Cemetery. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. 24-year-old John Donnelly from New Jersey got on his bike in San Francisco this past September, and he's been pedaling across the country, stopping along the way to talk with people about Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses. Donnelly just made his way through West Virginia, and West Virginia Public Radio's Glynis Board caught up with him on the phone to talk about the trip and the disease.
The Center for Disease Control reports that as many as 300,000 people in the country are infected. Lyme has long since outstripped AIDS as one of the fastest-growing epidemics in the U.S. Many suffer with chronic symptoms for years before they discover the problem, if they discover the problem. John Donnelly hopes his campaign encourages more open discussions and inspires more research so that people with Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses can have a better chance at restoring their health.
Yeah, so I came up with this idea because I had a very bad case of Lyme disease growing up, and like most people, didn't know a lot about it until I got sick, and it took me a few years to get a correct diagnosis.
Donnelly was eventually diagnosed. Then later, both of his parents, his younger sister and his aunt, were also diagnosed. Donnelly says once he was finally diagnosed, he was treated with the conventional 3-week heavy doses of antibiotics.
I got a lot better, so I was really healthy during high school. And then during college, all these old symptoms returned, and I developed like new bizarre symptoms like lockjaw anytime I yawned during class, tingling and numbness throughout my body, really weird ringing in my ears, neurological problems, degenerative arthritis, and a lot of other things that a 21-year-old shouldn't have been experiencing.
So then it was back to the races. It took another round of specialists scratching their heads, his symptoms continuing to progress, and more time before he was again diagnosed. Today, Donnelly says he's at 85-90%, healthy enough to ride across the country, and he says he feels lucky. That's why he approached an advocacy group, the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance in New York City, with the cycling project idea that's been dubbed Bite Back for a Cure.
Because this is an awareness building campaign, it's a fundraising campaign, but it's also a listening and story sharing ride. So I'm meeting and speaking with patients as I make my way across the country. We're doing filmed interviews and sharing all of that stuff on YouTube and Facebook.
I think one of the hardest things is just wondering if you're ever going to get better, you know? Like, there's times where I, you know, wondered, like, am I always going to have this? And that's hard to deal with because when you go from being completely healthy, you know, to kind of just having your health taken away from you, that's a really challenging moment, you know?
That's musician Caleb McGinn, who Donnelly interviewed along his path. In that video, McGinn admits that he felt he had to be his own health advocate in the sea of uncertain practices that may or may not lead to health. So let's just talk for a second about the controversy-ridden culture that led McGinn and so many like him to feel that way. Donnelly says one of the first problems is that the diagnostic test isn't always effective.
Patients may, you know, show up false negative for a while, and then after going misdiagnosed with other things, they come back with a positive Lyme disease diagnosis.
Then there's treatment. Basically, two schools of thought rule the day. One says about 3 weeks of heavy antibiotics will do the trick. And that might be true if caught early enough or if it just happens to work. But the Center for Disease Control reports that in at least 20% of the cases, symptoms return after a month's treatment. The second school of thought says in lieu of a cure, long-term, continuous courses of antibiotics is the only recourse many have. Of course, there are major problems with that course of action. Side effects, fears within communities about overuse of antibiotics, and then, of course, payment.
For many patients, insurance will not cover treatment that exceeds 1 month of oral antibiotics. So for people who cannot afford long-term treatment or don't have the resources to find any other means of getting better, this is an issue of massive social injustice. If you have the wherewithal, you probably can get treatment, but that's going to be out-of-pocket expenses. You know, people spend hundreds of thousands of dollars just trying to get better. So not only does this take a toll on your health, but people go bankrupt trying to get treatment.
And if it weren't already complicated enough, let's back up for a second. We aren't just talking about a single nasty bacteria. Lyme is just the town on the map where one particular pervasive bacteria is infamous for infecting the majority of the people. But other diseases are also transmitted by ticks. Those diseases are caused by infections from a variety of pathogens, including bacteria, viruses, and protozoa. One tick bite may transmit Lyme disease and over a dozen additional tick-borne diseases, so co-infections.
It's not just Lyme disease. There's a few known co-infections, and there's a dozen known pathogens that ticks carry. And, you know, if you were to see, you know, your regular physician, and maybe he does know to test you for Lyme disease, you may not get tested for all these other co-infections. So, you know, treating these diseases in their late and complicated forms, it's kind of become an art form for doctors. And there's just not enough known about these other pathogens. And that's why I'm doing this ride, just to bring awareness to all tick-borne diseases and to generate funding for new research.
Donnelly is now headed toward Philadelphia, and he hopes to end up in New York City by December 1st. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
A team of doctors at the University of Kentucky will investigate new treatments for patients with Parkinson's disease. As WEKU's Stu Johnson reports, it potentially could reverse the brain damage done by Parkinson's.
The current clinical trial focuses on transplanting a nerve taken from a patient's ankle and implanting it in the brain. So far, five patients have undergone the procedure. Principal investigator Dr. Craig Van Horn says the newly grafted nerves are also stimulated by electrodes. Over time, Van Horn says the hope is the brain will heal.
If we have substantial improvements at a year, that would be something that's really worth looking into further. Even if we don't reverse it, but if we can just halt the progression, I think we would be better off than we are now.
Parkinson's is one of the most common neurological disorders, affecting at least 10,000 Kentuckians. It's a progressive and degenerative disease causing tremors, rigidity, slow movement, and speech impairment. There is no known cure for Parkinson's. Lexington patient Rodney Parsons underwent the deep brain stimulation procedure last spring. Even without the nerve grafting, it made quite a difference.
I was walking away, bent over like this, stood straight up immediately, and that was turned it on, that's been it.
Dr. Greg Earhart, who directs the Morris K. Udall Parkinson's Disease Research Center, says the ailment is quite common in rural areas like Appalachia.
Environmental effects on individuals such as, toxins and or metals, heavy metals, well water, seem to increase the incidence of Parkinson's disease.
Still, Gerhardt says the disease's cause remains a total mystery. Researchers say it may take about a year to determine how well this nerve therapy works. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Nearly 200 authors and illustrators participated recently in the 32nd Kentucky Book Fair. One of those writers was Western Kentucky University professor and novelist David Bell, who spoke with WEKU's John Hingsbergen about the process of writing and his novel, Never Come Back.
Never Come Back tells the story of a woman named Elizabeth Hampton. She's 26 years old. She's a graduate student. And I'm not giving anything away to say that on the very first page of the book, Elizabeth's mother turns up dead. And so the first question is, what happened to her mother? Did she die of natural causes or did she meet foul play? As Elizabeth looks into this more and as she finds out more about her mother, Elizabeth finds out that her mother had an entire life that Elizabeth did not know about, that there are secrets in her mother's past, that there are dark things in her mother's past, and that Elizabeth never knew about these things. And as she finds out about them, she starts to get closer to the answers about what really happened to her mother. So it's really about family secrets coming out. It's also about, I think we all grow up thinking that our parents didn't have lives before we were born. We think the day we were born is when our parents started existing. But it's about Elizabeth realizing that her mother had this entire life, this complex life, before Elizabeth was even born. And she's just coming to grips with all of that.
Where does a story like this come from as the writer? Is it from personal experience at some level, from other influences in your life?
The plot line itself, you know, the things that happen in the book are made up. I don't have these crazy things happening in my life. The things that the characters are dealing with, the emotions, the thoughts, the growth that the characters go through, those things come from my life or from the lives of people who I observe. So, I mean, we all think about our families. We all think about how complex our family relationships are. Families are a place where we feel very safe, usually, and we feel the most at home and the most comfortable. But families can also be sources of a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of frustration and a lot of anger. And so I think that being in a family is a universal experience. We're all in families of some kind. And so it's natural to write about families and how complicated it can be to be in a family.
As a novelist, what are the challenges you face in forming characters, creating dialogue, creating relationships among them?
I think people read almost any book for the characters. I think sometimes there's a misconception that if you're writing a thriller or a mystery novel, that it's more about plot than it is about character, and that other books, like a really literary novel, might be more about character than it is about plot. But I think that any book worth reading has to have good characters, has to start with characters. So I think the challenge for any writer is to create characters who the reader understands. They should not be perfect characters. I don't write about perfect people. I don't write about saints or superheroes or people without flaws. I think people want to read about characters with flaws because we all have flaws and we're used to dealing with people with flaws. So I think that's the challenge, is to write about characters who are recognizable and easy for the reader to understand, who the reader can empathize with. And sometimes those characters may do things that challenge the reader, that make it difficult for the reader to decide if they really like that character or not. And I think that's okay. I think it's okay for a writer to make it difficult for the reader to decide how much they really like a character or how much they empathize with the character. I think in the end, if the reader understands something about the character, then the reader's going to go where that character goes.
I assume the process varies from author to author, but which comes first for you, the story or the characters?
Yeah, usually I think it starts with the characters. I think it starts with a situation. What if your mother died and you found out that she had a secret past, right? My book, Cemetery Girl. What if you had a child who disappeared and that child was gone for 4 years and then came back and refused to tell you where she was? So, I mean, usually it starts with a situation. Usually it's a what-if game. It's just the oldest act of imagination that I think we all do, going back to when we're kids, is saying, what if? You know, what if this happened? What if we did this? What if that happened? So it usually starts with that. And then it's a matter of seeing where those characters want to go. You know, where, if I imagine this character, what kind of trouble are they going to get into? Because that's what people read for. They want to see those characters digging themselves into a hole, and then can they dig their way out before the end of the book?
Will readers of Never Come Back recognize Kentucky or southwestern Ohio in the story, or Bloomington, Indiana, for that matter?
My books are all set in made-up places, and they're set in towns in Ohio. But I think that if you know a place like Bowling Green, like Cemetery Girl has a lot about a place that looks very much like Kiriakis Park and Fairview Cemetery. So usually I'm writing about mid-sized towns, kind of like Bowling Green. So in Never Come Back, she's a graduate student, so there's a university there. So, I mean, I think I am writing about places that are familiar to me. I also like writing about those mid-sized towns because we tend to think of crime and wild things happening in big cities. But I think anyone who's lived in a mid-sized town or a small town or a college town, they know that as many strange things happen in those towns as can happen in a big city, and that strange things happen in Ohio or Kentucky or Indiana as happen in New York City or Los Angeles.
That was Western Kentucky University professor and novelist David Bell talking with WEKU's John Hingsbergen about his novel, Never Come Back. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at our new website, wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.